And I got the technological issues resolved, and we will move on with our guest tonight. His name is Dr. Paul LaViolette, and he is the author of a number of books, some of which we've talked about with him before on the air. The books include Beyond the Big Bang, Earth Under Fire, which, of course, is available in video as well, Earth Under Fire, and that's a video that, coincidentally or otherwise, was produced by Jay Widener, who's a friend and a friend of the program and who was on the air just a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, Dr. LaViolette has a degree in physics from Johns Hopkins, received a Ph.D. in systems theory from Portland State. He is a man whose views are highly sought after in certain circles, and we are very fortunate to have him with us tonight. And so without further ado and delay, we will bring him right on the air now. So Dr. Paul, thanks for sticking with us and being persistent. Hi, how are you? All right, thanks so much. We got our technological issues worked out, and we've got Dr. Paul on the line now. Paul, you're for the listeners, you're on the East Coast. You're in New York somewhere at this point?
Yeah, upstate New York.
Upstate New York, okay. All right, well, I tell you what.
Almost 1 o'clock.
Almost 1 o'clock, yeah. So thanks, first of all, for staying up late into the evening hours and spending your time with us. And thanks for all the work that you've done, of which we're going to discuss starting right now, okay?
Sure.
All right, so the last time that you were on the air, we talked quite a bit, actually, about the primary focus of your research, and I'll let you sort of lay it out, but it has to do with galactic core explosions, these violent explosions that occur at the center of galaxies, and your research led you to the ice samples in Antarctica. Maybe we could start there, and we could talk a little bit about the theory and about what you find, what you found in those ice core samples.
Okay. Yes, I was testing the theory. This was something I was doing for my PhD work in the early 80s. I had gotten some ice from Greenland and Antarctica. Particularly in Greenland, I found high levels of cosmic dust in the Ice Age part of the core, which was confirming my hypothesis, which was that there had been a volley of cosmic rays coming from the galactic center around that time and had pushed in cosmic dust into the solar system and caused climatic a climatic mess, so to speak, in the solar system. It filled the area with dust, occluded the sun so that the radiation reaching the Earth was coming with a different spectrum, much more reddened. You were getting light scattering. You wouldn't have seen the stars. You would have gotten a lot more radiation actually coming to the Earth, but it wouldn't have been visible. Would have been much of it infrared. It would have created a what I call the interplanetary hothouse effect. And then on top of that, it would have activated the sun and caused solar flaring almost continually. Ice formation of the ice sheets. Also ice melting. So there was all various aspects of this. But one of the key tests was to see if there was elevated levels of cosmic dust in the polar ice cap.
How do you tell if there's cosmic dust? Is there a particular element or something that you're looking for?
Yeah. You look, for example, for iridium or nickel, and these are very at very high levels in cosmic dust, but on Earth they're much lower, and particularly iridium is a precious metal. It's about 10,000 times more abundant in cosmic material. gold was another one, and I did find gold at a fairly high level. As far as I know, I was the first to detect gold in polar ice.
Interesting. What about beryllium? Wasn't that one you were looking for, too?
No, to do that, you need a different technique of analysis. They find that with mass spectrometers.
Hmm.
I was using neutron activation, which was where you bombard your sample in a reactor, make it radioactive, and then you measure gamma rays.
Hmm.
From that, you're
right.
Able to tell what's in it.
Okay.
Whereas beryllium-10, it's a radioactive isotope of beryllium that's created in the atmosphere when the atmosphere is bombarded with cosmic rays. And to separate that particular isotope from the other beryllium isotopes, you need an accelerator.
Hmm.
So it's a totally different approach. But other people had done that work.
Okay.
So that's another... predicting high levels of that, and the other groups had found high levels.
Okay. All right. So in the ice samples, you found these elevated levels of...
Well, yeah, iridium, nickel. In fact, they were in the ratios that you would that they see in cosmic material, like comet or meteorite material, which tends to be very convincing that it was actually extraterrestrial and not contamination. It's difficult to make a case for contamination because where would all this iridium come from?
Right,
not from the laboratory.
Right. In other words, there's not an obvious terrestrial source for this stuff.
Right. If anything, if the laboratory dust had contaminated the samples, it would have diluted rather than created, all this iridium.
Right. Okay.
We also found large amounts of tin in one sample, which was known to be there before because Lonnie Thompson, glaciologist at Ohio State, had found it and was puzzled by what was this tin. In fact, it was up to like 70%, 60 or 70% of it of the sample was tin at one depth.
Huh.
And
wow.
I worked with some people in Australia who were just beginning to measure isotopes of tin. And one of the things is if you find an isotopic anomaly in an element, this is another indication that it could be extraterrestrial, because if these tin particles were out in space, they'd get bombarded with cosmic rays, and it would change their isotopic ratios compared to what we have on Earth.
Okay.
And in fact, they did find a significant isotopic anomaly in this tin, which was the first time such a thing had been found.
Interesting. They would say, and they were puzzled trying to come up with an answer for it.
Yeah. This tin, though, came from a different depth than the area I was testing. I was planning to test the period between 16,000 and 12,000 years ago, which was the end of the Ice Age. And
right.
It was also a time there where we had the worst mass extinction of animals since the time of the dinosaurs, the dying off of the mastodons and mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. So this was the period I was interested in, but my ice core work ended up testing an earlier period, so I was looking actually at an earlier superwave.
All right, well, that was the next question then, was once you take the ice core, what are the date, the time frames that you're looking at? So we're talking about, what did you say, 16,000 years before the present date? So what's that, 14,000 BC, something like that?
Right. The way I had gotten, there was a clue as to where to look. At the time I was doing this, I was studying ancient myths and lores, and I discovered there was a very advanced science encoded in these lores.
Right, which we've talked about, yeah.
And we're talking about a space-age science. Whoever had encoded this stuff was at least as advanced as we are or more advanced. And at the same time, I was studying astronomy because I was working on a new physics theory. So I was studying things like pulsars and pulsating stars and stellar evolution, cosmology, things like this.
Right.
And having these two tracks of investigation going, one day I was, I noticed that there was this myth that Sagittarius is shooting at the scorpion. These were part of this message that I was deciphering. And so when I laid out this arrow trajectory, as the myth talked about, it came within a few degrees of the galactic center. And then I realized that this was actually pointing, because there was an arrow there, the arrow of Sagittarius.
Right, right, the archer.
Was actually, it was purposely put there to point out the galactic center. All those stars have moved since the time. This was thousands of years back when these constellations were formed.
And right, right, right. And maybe you could address that actually for a second. And Paul, let me add a couple things actually. First of all, you're listening to Radio Orbit. My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. And you can find information about Dr. LaViolette and his ideas and theories and books and papers, published papers that he's done over the years at his website, www.etheric.com. And there is another website that I'll mention now with sort of alternative information, not particularly relevant to the stuff we're talking about right now, but important nonetheless, certainly, and that is archivefreedom.org. Archivefreedom.org. So both of those websites are ones to put on your list to check out. And Dr. Paul, do you have an 800 number as well that we might give out?
Yeah, 1-800-715-9993.
715-9993.
Yeah, they should be able to take orders beginning tomorrow morning from normal daylight hours, early evening.
Okay, so so on the web at etheric, etheric.com, and an 800 number for books and materials, 1-800-715-9993. Okay, so So the idea of came from this ancient mythology, and I was going to ask you, you know, the idea of the constellations, where does that come from? The constellations are sort of arbitrary. In other words, I can come up with lots of different designs if I stare at the sky. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, why did the 12 that were eventually chosen as ones that we all know, why were they even chosen to begin with?
Yeah, this is something that puzzled me a bit, you know, because there's various zodiacs. These are in particular zodiacal constellations.
Mm-hmm, right.
We have the zodiac that we're familiar with that's in Western astrology. But then the Mesopotamians actually had, I believe, something like 18 constellations along the zodiac. And then the Chinese, of course, have their constellations. But the ones that were part of this message that were designed actually as a cryptographic message, they employed certain cryptographic techniques, was the zodiac that's been handed down to us presently that involves normal signs of Taurus, Aries, Pisces, and so on. So why it is that the others didn't, you know, I'm not saying that all constellations out there are part of a message. It just happened that this set,
right,
I had discovered was, and also it included some constellations off of the ecliptic, which would be include like Sagitta Aquila.
Mm.
Aquila is the eagle and is holding the arrow Sagitta in its claw, and actually a symbol on the dollar bill,
right, right,
sort of connotes that. And then there's another constellation at the other side of the in the southern hemisphere called Centaurus and Crucis, which is the cross, Southern
mm-hmm.
Cross. Actually,
right,
they used
cross.
To be one constellation at one time. And these two constellations, they're on the galactic equator.
At particularly important positions, too, correct?
Right, yeah. They're at the one radian points, which by one radian, think of a circle. and you take the radius of the circle and you mark it off along the circumference,
mm-hmm.
and that angle is equal to 1 radian. It's about 57.295 degrees.
Okay.
And so if you take as the center of the circle, like let's say we're looking at the galactic center, and you say that's the point on the circumference.
Right.
We're at the center of the circle, and the galactic center is on the circumference. Now you mark off 1 radian off to the side, and that's where you find Sagitta, the tip of the arrow. So this can't be just coincidence.
Right, and that's on the relatively speaking, on the north side, if we were observing the galactic center, is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And then what's on the south side?
The south side you have Centaurus, and the Southern Cross is right at the southern galactic 1 radian point.
Hmm. Okay.
The little cross, the tip of the cross that faces the galactic center is marking that southern 1 radian point.
Okay.
And then you'll have the other arrow. So you've got two arrows, really. One is the Sagitta, which is flying outward from the galactic center, and the other is Sagittarius, who's aiming his arrow at the galactic center.
Okay.
And you get the impression, because it uses this metaphoric symbology to communicate its ideas, and you see what it's illustrating is that this arrow really, it's indicating an explosion date, and then the Sagitta arrow is the result of that explosion that flew out. In other words, the cosmic rays.
Hmm.
And 1 radian would be the distance from the galactic center to us. So instead of talking about angles now, we think of it as a distance.
Hmm.
That's marking the distance from the galactic center to Earth. So metaphorically, they're talking about the results of that explosion actually reach the Earth on that date that they're marking.
Hmm. Very interesting. Okay, so all right, we'll get back to this the importance of this radian idea in a minute, but let's get back to the explosions itself and the core samples. I guess I want to sort of tie that up because apparently we have in the Antarctic and in these samples we have as an accepted fact, a scientific fact that this happens, that these are the results of high intensity periods of cosmic ray incidents, correct?
Right, the beryllium 10 graphs that indicate cosmic ray intensity striking the Earth's atmosphere. And we see peaks, and there's a set of peaks right at that time when the message is indicating something was happening. And previous times, there's one very large cosmic ray peak around 37,000 years ago, which was the time of the extinction of Neanderthal, which is interesting.
Interesting. And also the time of the rise of the next version.
Right, the Cro-Magnon. They supposedly dated back earlier, but they gained more of the...
Dominance or whatever.
Dominance,
Yeah, they for whatever reason, didn't die off, yeah.
And you see in the myths, like the Hopi and the Mayan myths and so on, and other myths from all over the world, they talk about different ages and different races that existed that became extinct at certain times. And so this could be, for example, a reference to one of the species that once existed on the planet.
Yeah, and they reference different suns in many cases. They talk about the fourth sun, the fifth sun, this sort of thing.
And when you look at the ice core record, you see that the times of the terminations of ice ages, like not only the previous ice age, but the one before that, coincided with these huge peaks of cosmic rays and the beginnings of the ice ages. So we had an interglacial period of something like 9 to 11,000 years between those two last ice ages, and suddenly... there was another peak of cosmic rays, and glaciation began. So these appear to be climatic triggers.
Yeah, but not necessarily a trigger for either or. It can be a trigger for maybe a warming cycle or a cooling cycle, apparently.
Yeah, and I think part of it has to do with how long the superwave lasts. So if it's a shorter superwave, more moderate, let's say... might last up from 100 to 1,000 years, and be a moderate peak that is able to push cosmic dust into the solar system. That could create conditions that would foster glacial growth.
Hmm.
And it would also have to do with the phase of the Earth's precessional cycle. But then if it was one that lasted longer, to the point that the sun began to become active, then the sun would heat up and you'd have a glacial recession phase.
Okay.
So if the ice sheets were already there, they would melt. So that requires a more extended event.
In other words, it takes longer to push material, et cetera, through the solar wind where it can actually have a significant effect on our star.
Well, it pushes it through the solar wind in either case.
Mm-hmm.
But it hangs around. If it hangs around long enough, then the sun is going to heat up, is going to get disturbed.
Does it add mass to the sun, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This stuff falls on the sun, and there is a correlation between the rate of matter input to the sun and the level of solar flare activity.
Hmm. Okay.
Studies
okay.
on this.
Mm-hmm.
But you wanted to talk about that evidence also in the bird core, right, that where they found a spike of acidic material it dated 15,800 years. The original discoverers had dated it around 17,500 years old, but when you do a proper dating of the core, you come up with a more recent date, 15,800 years, which is the date that the zodiac is indicating. That's when the arrow indicator lines up exactly with the heart of the scorpion,
right,
as the myth talks about.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with astronomical software and this sort of thing, how is it that we know the way things looked 15,000 years ago, et cetera? Maybe you could explain really quickly how we know the positions of stars, constellations, either in the past or in the future.
Well, today we observe that the stars' positions change very slowly each year. And it's called proper motion.
Mm-hmm.
And each star has not only its position in the sky, right ascension, declination, but the rate at which those coordinates change. And knowing that, you can project back where that star would have been so many thousands of years ago.
Because that's a very constant rate of change.
Right. And so you can take any constellation map and project it back. In fact, there are programs that do this.
Okay.
I was doing this, but with calculations were more accurate than what you get in your typical program, which is just basically to get an idea of what these would look like.
Right.
In fact, I also had to perform what's called cartographic corrections, because you're dealing with Mercator projections, and that when you map those out, it's not exactly the way it would look in the sky, so you have to make corrections.
Mm. Yeah, and for people out there listening, Dr. LaViolette received his PhD. This was your thesis, as a matter of fact. Is that correct?
Yes, except for the the message part. I didn't put in about the
how
I got the idea.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they'd have thrown you out of the place, you know.
I did write it up, actually, as a pre-proposal, which was between me and my dissertation chairman.
Interesting.
But the dean wouldn't have approved that sort of thing. You have to understand, the only reason I could have done this investigation for a PhD was I had a very open-minded dissertation committee chairman, Dr. Landeros, and the program was an interdisciplinary program, which one of its objectives was to solve problems taking an interdisciplinary approach, bringing many fields or disciplines to bear on the problem.
Wow, what an idea.
So think of CSI. It's exactly what you have here. You know, the TV program.
Yes.
You're dealing with a crime scene, In other words, the crime occurred at some time in the past, and here's the evidence here and there, and it's sort of tucked away in different disciplines.
Right.
But the scientists don't communicate with each other because they're specialized.
Right.
So nobody solves the crime.
Right.
But a systems scientist comes in, and their purpose is to cross the disciplines. They're sort of generalists and bring all the data needed together, and then you see the pattern emerges and becomes obvious what happened.
Right. Well, your work has been stunning as a layman, you know, and for many others like me, I can certainly say that it was stunning and striking, and you know, some things just sort of once they become apparent, quite honestly, Dr. Paul, and I think I think you make this very clear, that one of the reasons that they're encoded the way they are, and one of the reasons that they're passed along the way they are, is that once that they're shown, you don't have to be a PhD genius like yourself to figure it out. It becomes something that's even available to the common guy who doesn't have the advanced training of someone like you.
In my book, I try to put as much of the facts out there so people can come to their own conclusions about this. Because I don't want people just to take my word. Mm-hmm. This whole thing is so fantastic or mind-altering that you really need to give the evidence to the people reading the book to make their own decisions. You know.
Well, the first thing is that it is an accepted fact. Now, we know that these core explosions happen, or we know that these cosmic ray volleys happen. I guess it's sort of induction to say that it's the core explosion, but I'm sure that you can argue that.
We see it happening in another galaxy.
Right. So we see it happening.
Quasar, for example, is an example of a very intense explosion of this.
Right. Again, perfectly well documented cosmic phenomenon that does this sort of thing. So we know it happens. Give us an idea of the frequency. It looks like you've looked pretty seriously at the core samples. What do you? I think that you have an idea of how many years, plus or minus.
Plus or minus for what?
Well, what's the frequency of these outbursts?
The large ones occur about every 13,000 to 26,000 years.
Okay, so there's quite a large window there.
To grapple with this problem of frequency, I developed a magnitude scale like you have for earthquakes or tornadoes.
Right.
So I've broken it into four magnitudes.
And again, all these are based on samples that were taken from the ice cores. Is that correct?
To a large extent.
A large extent. Okay.
Magnitude one would be the weakest. Magnitude four, the strongest. And maybe in the future that could make some changes to the scale.
Right, like the hurricanes we have these days, that they may have to up the scale, you know?
Right. And so magnitude one would be a superwave that you didn't see evidence of it in the beryllium 10 record of the ice core. So it wasn't strong enough to poke its head above the background.
Okay.
But it was still something that occurs, and we have evidence that there were something like 14 of such events in the last 5,300 years, from looking at the galactic center. You see these puffs of gas that have come out from the galactic center.
Okay.
And the last one of these sorts occurred 700 years ago. And there have been only a few out of these 14 that have gone longer than 700 years. So you know, we may be imminent for another one of these small, at least of the small ones. Then the magnitude 2 would be larger ones that you actually see them as spikes in the record, but they're not strong enough to make a climatic change. So you'd see the cosmic ray peaks, but they'd be so brief that there wasn't a major change like initiating an ice age or terminating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they could cause some temporary climatic blizzards, things like this. There was one like this 5,300 years ago, around the time of the beginning of the Mayan calendar. Then magnitude 3 would be a longer duration superwave, one that would last from a few hundred to 1,000 years.
Okay.
and be more intense. Maybe it would double the background level of a cosmic ray background level. And that would be strong enough to initiate an ice age. It would push in enough dust to do that kind of thing. And then magnitude 4 would be even stronger, maybe 2 to 4-fold above background, last several thousand years. And that would be enough to activate to the sun to the point that it would become like a T Tauri star. A lot of flaring. You would have coronal mass ejections hitting the Earth, and would actually warm the climate to the point where you get rapid melting of the ice sheets, continental flooding due to the ice melting, this sort of thing.
So let me ask you a question about the rapidity of onset of this sort of thing. When, first of all, when the volley, the increase in cosmic rays reaches us here at Earth, that means that the explosion occurred 23,000 years ago.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that.
But we didn't see it coming because the cosmic rays travel as fast as light from the initial outburst.
Okay. So by the time you see it,
then it's on your doorstep.
Great.
Unless there was a buildup. Let's say there was some rumblings at the galactic center that was setting out some warning signals.
Right, which sort of makes sense. I mean, if you look at the sun, I sort of look at the whole thing as like fractal, you know, self-similar things, just scale being the only thing that's different. And the sun certainly goes through cycles, and when it has certain signatures that you see in its magnetic fields and et cetera, you know, you can sort of go, oh man, it might be coming. You know, we know when M-class and X-class flares are have high potential, and we also know when there are low potential for them, you know.
But it looks like these things can have onsets within a matter of a decade, at least, just looking at the ice core record, which is pretty quick in
really
terms
quick.
Of geological time. But it could be much faster than that. I mean, it could be overnight. It's just that we don't have any way of knowing from the records. They're not high enough resolution.
You know, there are strange, unexplained occurrences too in the archaeological records. You know, I've always wondered what happened that could have frozen mammoths, mastodons, etc., with, you know, that still had buttercups in their mouths, you know, and have been found basically flash frozen or something is what it appears. I mean that's what it appears. So yeah, I mean, there are still lots of questions as to, there's certainly some strange things that have happened that we can't quite explain yet.
Yes.
All right, well, okay, so we know that the stuff happens. We have an idea about the frequency, and apparently it's just like you say, it's not now and then, it's just different levels of frequency over time, and there are probably cycles within cycles that we may or may not yet be aware of.
And these small ones would be very devastating for us sociologically as modern technological society that depends on satellites or cell phones and television communications and so on.
These
would be wiped out by electromagnetic pulse from this sort of event. There would also be a gravity wave component. The tsunami, which on my website, there's a web page that talks about the tsunami.
Right, right.
And I show that there was a very strong gamma ray burst within less than 2 days after it arrived, which is the sequence you'd expect. You expect first the earthquake, which would be triggered by the
gravity wave. Right.
and then would arrive the gamma ray burst, and that's exactly what you found. And both of those events were first class in the period of the last 30 years. There was nothing to compare with those two events, and they occurred so close together. Well, the magnitude 1 superwave would be much more powerful than that tsunami.
Wow.
That was created, they found that gamma ray burst came from a star, not from a galactic core. That was a star within our galaxy, close to the center of the galaxy.
Hmm.
But a core explosion, we're talking on a bigger scale.
Right, it's like multiplied many-fold.
So, you know, all these things, without even creating climatic problems, you'd still have some major disasters from such an event.
Right, even at the lowest level.
Right.
Even at the lowest level. Amazing. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what the effects then would be. We have tectonic effects, obviously.
Besides the earthquakes, you have EMP. This is caused by the gamma ray burst. When it strikes the atmosphere, it will create an electromagnetic wave front, which would overload power lines, create blackouts.
And that's what fries all the satellites and all that.
Right, that would fry your satellites. The blackouts we've experienced are nothing compared to what would happen during such an event. These would blow transformers all over the continent.
So literally it would be lights out pretty much.
Yeah, let's put it this way. There'd be a lot of work for the repairmen to do. You have to figure for a month you might not have electricity. The thing is, we have not gone through this in historical times. Even 700 years ago, we didn't have
technology as we have it.
Electricity, using electrical devices and so on. We didn't have things that could get blown out by an electromagnetic pulse coming through your lines and frying your chips. Mm-hmm. Cars now, they have chips in them.
Right.
Which probably you wouldn't be able to start your car if such a thing happened. We're affected in a different way than we would have 700 years ago.
Amazing. Yeah, it's certainly interesting how dependent upon the technology we have become. I mean, even as a real personal example, I mean, the fact that you and me even are communicating, is all because of these wires and chips and transistors and all of these things that are very fragile, apparently.
And that tsunami gamma ray burst came pretty close. It did disturb some of the satellites, as you remember.
I know. And that earthquake was a significant event. Geologically speaking, there were many stories that came out over the last year or so since it happened about what a significant event it really was, geologically speaking.
Yeah.
You know, the gamma ray bursts happen all the time. Ever since you and I have become familiar with one another, and I've gotten more interested in your work, and I have a very close friend who runs a website called cyberspaceorbit.com. And his name is Kent Stedman, and he's a fan of your work. And he watches the gamma ray burst. There are a couple of different universities that sort of watch that stuff, and they post all of the gamma ray bursts as they occur or as they're identified. And they seem to happen really often, Paul. Like they're the average is close to one a day, actually, that gets posted up there.
Yeah, well, these are occurring all over the universe and reaching us. The ones that occur within our galaxy are very rare, like that one that did occur within our galaxy. We got this tsunami occurring right near it. These smaller ones, these everyday ones, are not what should worry us. the more rare events. And they take you by surprise, unfortunately.
Yeah, again, it seems that they're difficult to predict with, I mean, outside of just a very short opportunity, maybe.
Did you have some questions on gamma ray bursts that come in?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. There were a couple interesting ones, as a matter of fact. The first one you sort of addressed already. A listener asked, please ask Dr. LaViolette how one can locate the origin of a gamma ray burst. In addition, how can one determine whether its source is from within our galaxy or outside of our galaxy?
Well, there's several gamma ray detector satellites up there. So depending on when each satellite first picks up the burst, they can sort of triangulate and find out where it came from, and where in the sky it originated from. So if you think of, let's say, three satellites, one is at your left hand, the other at your right hand, the other in front of you.
Okay.
If the burst had come from the left, from your left, it's going to reach your left satellite first, and then the middle one,
and
finally the right one.
Mm-hmm.
So you put that in your computer, and the computer will triangulate, say, okay, it's from over there. If it arrived simultaneously on all three, you'd know it probably came from above.
Mm.
So
interesting.
That's essentially what they do. And then once they get a general target area to look at, they train their telescopes, and that was the idea of the Swift gamma ray satellite, was it could inform them quickly with its network of telescopes where to look. And so within seconds, they would be notified, their buzzers would go off, and they'd run to the telescopes and give the coordinates and then look, and they would hopefully see the dying optical counterpart and be able to see what was the source and hopefully see that there was a galaxy or something there.
Okay.
Once they see a galaxy, then they can look at the redshift of the galaxy, and that tells them how far away it came from.
Okay.
Or if it came from within our own.
Are there occurrences where it comes from other places? For example, it doesn't come from a galaxy, or they're not sure of the source?
I don't know. Maybe there are a few that they don't know. They haven't been able to see the galaxy. Maybe it's so far away. You know?
Okay. In other words, it's typical. In other words, that we do know the sources of these things, and that they come primarily from star explosions or from galactic explosions.
Well, they divide them into short bursts and long bursts.
Right.
Long bursts, they find, correlate with supernova explosions in the distant galaxy. Whereas the short bursts, they don't see any supernova explosions. So there they're left to wonder what caused it, and they've come up with a theory that maybe it's two neutron stars in a binary neutron star system that collide. And when they fuse, at that moment, it creates this explosion that's very powerful and very short, much quicker than a supernova, because a supernova takes time to expand, so it can last much longer, have its gamma ray burst last much longer.
Yeah, interestingly, there have been a couple of gamma ray bursts just over the last week or so that you and I were chatting about off the air that were very long. One was like 700 seconds, I think, in duration. The other one was 900 seconds, which I think is the longest one, or at least one of the longest that's on record.
Right. So
what does that mean exactly?
Supernova explosion.
Really? So could those particularly have any effect, or?
I don't think they were that strong. I mean, compared to the one that was occurring in December of 2004.
And again, we're sort of doing the recap now. We would know already, right?
Yeah, now one thing that worries me is that they might, if a real strong one occurred, that they might keep it to themselves. That's exactly what they did last time. They didn't inform us about it until a month and a half later.
That's right.
It was the middle of February.
Right.
Now we've got to inform people, get this out in the news as soon as it occurs. There's a book by Fred Hoyle, and his son called Inferno, which is a science fiction story about what might happen if there was a very strong galactic core explosion.
Mm-hmm.
They were proposing one that was so strong that they had to head up towards the Arctic Circle to get away from the radiation. But in that story, which sounds quite realistic, the astronomers were mulling over what this was, and they didn't announce it for a long time.
Right.
You know, it's very realistic, actually. We've got to get away from that. We have to have some sort of warning system to get the word out when these things happen.
Yeah, it is really strange that there's a demonstrated historical precedent for basically trying to keep the stuff quiet as opposed to trying to proliferate the information. I mean, I guess that those become cultural and psychological issues, which are certainly we have our issues right now culturally that we need to.
We can take as a precedent the tsunami. It looks like the earthquakes would be the first signal, and then would come the gamma ray event.
All right, so
were there any other questions?
Yeah, well, let me. I'm going to go out on a limb and mention this one, only because it sort of struck me, and you know, I don't know. So I'm just going to see what your take is, and if you tell me just to forget it, then I'll forget it. This guy says, taking into consideration quantum space, space-time non-locality and gamma ray bursts, is it possible that GRBs are thin places in space-time, and is distance really a factor?
Now, what do you think he means by thin places?
Well, I think he, I don't know, maybe places where the veil is where it's thin, and maybe something is peeking through from another. I don't know, dimension or something. The reason I think that he mentions this, and I've had a conversation with this guy about it, he's been sort of following gamma ray bursts, and he seems to think that there are simultaneous things that happen, like you're talking about. But he seems to think that maybe there's a non-local reaction that happens when one of these things occurs that sort of lights up a whole bunch of stuff, like a Christmas tree almost, and that regardless of distance or time in between, the gamma ray burst can have an immediate and literally instantaneous effect on different celestial bodies, maybe stars, maybe even our sun. Does that even hold any water?
Well, with the one that occurred in 2004, they talked about it reflecting off the moon. Maybe you think that's where you get the idea from?
I'm not sure, and that really confuses me.
Well, if you imagine, suppose the moon was off to one side, but in the direction of where this gamma ray burst had come from, right?
Okay.
It would have scattered from its surface at a very low angle towards us, so it would have, in effect, reflected then off the moon.
Interesting.
So, because gamma rays reflect off of
solid objects.
Solid objects, just like light. As long as the angle is a low angle.
Wow. Well.
But I'm not a believer in Einsteinian space-time. You can gather that from reading my book, Genesis of the Cosmos.
No question about it. Well, and there are questions actually from listeners that are relative to that. I think all of this stuff is relevant to the galactic core explosion. So maybe we could talk about subquantum kinetics just for a minute, and there's a question right here about the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
A listener asks, "What's the best evidence, in your opinion?" Refuting the Big Bang, and there are a couple of related questions that I have. But anyway, maybe you could talk about that a little bit, the whole idea of the Big Bang and the expanding universe and all that.
Well, actually, I have a DVD available of one of my lectures about this. It's called Is the Universe Really Expanding? And I go into the cosmology of the Big Bang and point out a lot of the difficulties.
There was actually a published paper, I might add, with the same title, is that right?
Yes, published in Astrophysical Journal in 1986, and it's available on my website. People can download it. Be prepared, it's a bit technical, but at least the graphs, you can see from the graphs, it's taking data that's been published and giving a fair play to the alternative to the Big Bang, which is the tired light theory.
Mm.
The idea that the universe is not expanding, but that the redshift is due to something else. It's due to light losing energy that travels through space. And this is a cosmology that often is not plotted on the data. So it's sort of like, think of cosmology as a religion, and they only toot their own horn, Big Bang Theory, unfortunately. And what they should be doing is being interested in science and putting the alternative theories on to see which fits better. And what you do when you do this, these tests, you find that consistently the tired light model fits the data better with the fewest assumptions. And that that emerges when you do many tests, many different kinds of cosmology tests. Because in the past, Big Bang theorists have been adjusting their data so it would fit the model. And they call these evolutionary corrections. But when you make these corrections on one test, usually your fit goes off on the other test.
On the other test, right.
So this is sort of like a Chinese handcuff when you use more than one test.
Right.
And I've updated that paper in Subquantum Kinetics, the book Subquantum Kinetics.
Let me mention real fast the website and, again, the 800 number. My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette, and if you haven't figured it out yet, he is well worth listening to, and his research is worth looking into, and his books are well worth reading. And much of this information can be investigated at www.etheric.com, etheric.com, and there is an 800 number where his books and materials are available, and that's 1-800-715-9993. And, of course, Dr. Paul's website and materials are also linked over at my website at mikehagan.com as well. And all right, well, let's continue with that.
Let me just point out the Genesis of a Cosmos, the book which also talks about ancient myth.
Right.
A large part of the book is about cosmology and discusses this stationary universe cosmology and these tests more for the layman. So if you're not too technically oriented, this book could explain fairly well this evidence against the Big Bang Theory. If you want something more technical that you can take to your professor at the university and say, well, here's the evidence, just read it, that would be Subquantum Kinetics.
Right.
And if you want to crusade on this, get your local university library to carry it so we get the book out there. In fact, I was contacted by one lady who feels that Subquantum Kinetics will be the science of the future after the next cataclysm.
Well, I'll tell you what, Paul, a couple of things. You know, I'm in Columbia, Missouri, and you're familiar with Columbia because I know that some of the analysis of some of the core samples that you worked on were done here at the reactor at the University of Missouri.
Right. I sent the samples there to be irradiated because your reactor was one of the more high-power reactors in the U.S., and you needed very high power to do this iridium analysis. This was neutron activation analysis I was doing. It was the same procedure that was done in the discovery of the extinction of the dinosaurs, where they concluded there was a comet that had hit the Earth or an asteroid.
Right.
And they found a lot of iridium. So I was
I'd
read their paper and decided to use the same technique.
I see.
On core samples, although this was new, what I was doing, because they had never been tried before on ice, where you're dealing with milligrams of material instead of grams. You know.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, there's another thing that I'll mention with regard to the university. I actually have a contact in the physics library here, and it's a real interesting story that sort of came about over the last year, because I was given a book by Tom Bearden, Dr. Tom Bearden, who I'm sure you're probably familiar with.
Yes.
Anyway, he asked me if I would try. I mean, it's a long story, but to make it short, he asked me if I would try to get his book in the physics library here, and I did, and I have a contact there. So please, we'll talk off the air about this, but if it's not in the library here yet, there's certainly a good chance that we can get it in the library here at the University of Missouri.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, okay, and yeah, the fantastic stuff. All of Dr. LaViolette's books, I've read them all. I've read every one of them, and I just finished Talk of the Galaxy, one that we'll talk about here hopefully in a short time. But it's another amazing book, and it ties some of these things together with astonishing sort of conclusions. But at any rate, we have a situation. We certainly have a situation of these things occurring. They happen all the time. We talk about gamma ray bursts now. We've talked about galactic core explosions. We know they have an effect on the planet. Again, this is not speculation. So the question becomes time frame, like we've talked about a little bit, and then you know, the level of what might occur. And like you say, I mean, even these lower level occurrences are to a civilization that relies on electronics and technology the way we do, it's probably a real bump in the road.
Yeah, no, I was on the Coast to Coast show
End of December, yeah,
and,
fantastic show.
Got quite a few questions. Some people were concerned, you know, should they be building fallout shelters,
right, digging
how much
basement
dirt would take to stop this, and so on. So to alleviate some of the fears, I put on my website some answers to these questions, which you, if you go to the bottom, there's a link where it talks about questions and answers. Basically, from looking at the past record, I don't think you have to be worried to that extent. That these small events, as far as the gamma ray burst, if you just stay indoors, it will stop the electron shower, which will be more or less low-energy electrons, because electrons, it's hard for them to penetrate the atmosphere because they're such light particles.
Mm-hmm.
If it was protons, that's a different story.
Yeah, a little bit more mass, yeah.
Right. But you wonder, you know, about these stories of secret government projects building tunnels underground.
Mm. Yeah.
That makes you worried, you know, do they know something that they haven't told us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of documented evidence now that there's lots and lots of stuff that's going on underground, not only in this country. So.
But one thing that puzzled me is about the Super Collider Tunnel in Texas. It seems so ridiculous to be building this huge tunnel for you know, spending so much money. And then once they had it built, suddenly the project was killed.
Interesting. Yeah, so now they've got a huge underground complex. How convenient. All paid for, you know, and built. Yeah, there have been a number of projects over the years that have really piqued my interest. The Denver airport was one that I was really interested in. I was living in Denver for a long, long time, and man, that's a real, real questionable deal, what's going on under there.
Yeah, I heard the story from Jay Widener.
Man.
Going out there to work with him on the video.
Right. You guys did a wonderful video, by the way, and Jay's a friend of mine, and he's great, and he is a really interesting guy who has his own ideas of some things that are happening, and your work is quite central in some of Jay's ideas. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Earth Under Fire. That's the name. Actually, I think that's the. Of course, that's the name of the book, but also the video. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, is that available as well at on the
website? Yes. We have copies of that in DVD.
Okay. All right.
I think we have one VHS left.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We've been on the air for a long time without taking a break. Why don't we take a little break? Can you stick around for just a little while longer, and we can talk about some of these signposts that that are
sure.
in the sky? All right. Let's do that. We will take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment with my guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette. And as I've said a couple of times tonight, you can find out information about Dr. LaViolette at www.etheric.com. There is another website called Archive Freedom, just the way it sounds, archivefreedom.org, archivefreedom.org. And that's an important website as well. Put it in your bookmarks, and all of these websites that I'm talking about right now can be easily gotten to through my website at mikehagan.com, all right? Okay, so Dr. Paul, back in just a few minutes, we'll listen to a little bit of music from C3, who we featured on